This is a summary of Greenlights by bestbookbriefings.com. Greenlights by Matthew McConaughey. What's a greenlight? Greenlights mean go an affirmation of the paths we take in our lives. Greenlights are approval, gifts, success. Greenlights mean yes, we love them because they're easy, and they give us what we want. Sometimes, a green light can look like a yellow light, an interruption, and a pain. A red light is a full stop, a failure, and a death. We don't like them because they're hard. They slow us down, and they stop our flow. They say no, but sometimes they give us what we need. To catch a green light, you need skill through hard work or good choices, or by identifying where the red lights are and avoiding them. You need timing, both the world's and yours. Sometimes it's about being in the right place at the right time, a mixture of intuition and fate. The best way to get through life is by getting relative with the inevitable. By accepting that an outcome is inevitable, we can choose how to deal with it. We can persist, pivot, or concede. The secret to satisfaction is which one we choose and when. I believe that everything we do is part of a plan, even if things don't go the way you intend. Eventually, the red lights of yesterday will become the green lights of today. What goes down will come up. Outlaw logic. My parents got divorced twice and married each other thrice. They had vicious, bloody fights that ended with the two making love right then and there. Red lights turned to green. This was how they loved each other. The youngest of three brothers, I was an accident. Mom thought I was a tumor until the fifth month. On the day I was born, Dad went to the bar instead of hospital, because he thought I wasn't his I was. I got my ass whooped for the first time for answering to Matt, "You weren't." Named after a doormat. The second time was from telling my brother I hated him. My third was for saying I can't, and my fourth was for lying about a stolen pizza. In doing so, my parents taught me values. They taught me that my name was important. They taught me not to hate, never to say can't, to never lie. My mother was a true baller, proof that one's denial is only worth as much as one's commitment. She beat two kinds of cancer with nothing but a bottle of aspirin. She's the type of person who says I'm gonna before she can, and I'll be there before she's invited. In 1977, she entered me in the Little Mr. Texas contest. I won a big trophy. Mom took a picture, hung it on the kitchen wall. "Look at you, winner," she said to me every day. Last year, I found that picture in a scrapbook and took a closer look. The trophy said runner-up. I asked her about it. The kid who won, his family bought him a fancy three-piece suit. We call that cheating. No, you're Little Mr. Texas. My dad taught us common sense, discipline, loyalty, work ethic. He made sure we kids learned our fundamentals before we got individualistic. He was big on rites of passage. Mike, my oldest brother, got into the pipe selling business same as him. Dad was good, but Mike was great. In less than a year, he was at the top of the company, and the boss gave him their biggest account, a guy called Don Knowles. One evening, after a few beers, Dad told him, "Come on, son. Let's take the old 18-wheeler and steal some of Don Knowles' pipes." "I can't do that, Dad," Mike said. "I just got that account." My dad insisted, but Mike wouldn't budge. So they squared off. My dad was 6'4", 265 pounds. Mike was 5'10", 180. Mike grabbed a 2x4 and whacked Dad across the head with it. Dad went down, but he kept coming until Mike finally knocked him out. From that day on, Dad acknowledged Mike as his equal. He was man enough to take Dad on, and he proved it. I was a mama's boy, but I relished every moment I spent with my dad. In the summer of 1979, my mom went on an extended vacation, leaving me and Dad in a trailer on the outskirts of town. Dad had a cockatiel named Lucky, and they loved each other. One day, we got home and found Lucky drowned in the toilet. Weeping, my dad cradled her body and gave her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, measuring his breaths enough to revive her, but not pop her lungs. On his knees, over the bowl. One exhale, two, three, four, five. On the 10th, we heard from inside my father's mouth where Lucky's head was, a tiny chirp. Lucky lived for 8 more years. Find your frequency. I was rolling in senior high. I had straight A's, $45 in my pocket at all times, and I was dating the prettiest girl in town. I was catching green lights for sure. I danced, I hustled, I put in the effort. I drove a truck, and after school I took the girls mudding. I was that guy. But one day, I saw a candy red sports car for sale. I traded in my truck on the spot. That car was my baby. I polished it every Sunday afternoon. When I drove it to school, I parked in an empty lot in the back, where no other cars could scratch it, and I would just lean against it. I was so cool. I knew the chicks were going to dig it. A few weeks later, I realized I was learning all by myself, sans chicks. It was like they were bored with me. After school, they went mudding in someone else's truck. What happened? When I lost my truck, I lost the effort, the hustle. I'd gotten lazy, relying on the red sports car to do the work for me, and I'd lost my mojo in the process. The next day, I traded it back in for my truck, pulled into school, and just like that, I was back. Stupid sports car. When I graduated high school, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life, so I signed up to study in Australia. When they approved my papers, they asked me to sign a paper promising I wouldn't come back until my year was over. Apparently, every exchange student got homesick and tried to come back home early. I agreed to shake on it. 10 days later, I was in the Sydney International Airport, being warmly welcomed by my host family, the Dooleys. Norval was a balding man of 5'4" and 220 pounds, with an English accent he used to sound more proper. Marjorie was 4'10", wearing a white dress with big green dots, and using a walker for her hunchback. We drove to my new home. They told me they lived on the outskirts of Sydney, near the beach. Paradise, they said. After driving for an hour, I noticed the capital city was well behind us. You don't live in Sydney, do you? I asked. Sinful city, Norval proudly replied. No civilization there. We live in a place called Gosford. Near the coast. You're gonna love it. 40 minutes later, we were at Gosford, a city of a couple hundred thousand souls, with miles of beaches. This'll work, I thought. We kept driving. 20 minutes later, Gosford was in the rearview mirror. It's not actually Gosford, is it? I asked politely. Norval chuckled. No, still too citified, mate. We live just down the road, in Tuckley. You're gonna love it. 40 more minutes. Tuckley, population 5,000. One red light, one bar, one supermarket, but still on the coast. Very pretty. We kept driving. Pavement turned into black top. It's not really Tuckley, either? I asked, confused. Too big for our taste, Norval said, confident as ever. We live just a bit down the road, beautiful little place called Gorokan. You're gonna love it. A few minutes later. Gorokan, population 1,800. One street, no beach in sight. We took another turn, leaving Gorokan behind. Blacktop turned into dirt road. Annoyed, I stated. It isn't Gorokan either, is it? No, Norval grunted. But we're VRRY close. Just down the trail, beautiful. Country spot, you're gonna love it. 5 miles down the dusty trail. A green sign said Warnervale, Pop 305. We drove a mile past and pulled into the driveway of the only house in sight. Norval turned off the ignition. Welcome to Australia, he said with great fanfare. You're gonna love it. A few days later, I was washing dishes when Norval and Marjorie suggested I cook something American for the weekend. Nothing more American than a cheeseburger, I said. The man who invented the cheeseburger was a genius. Norval frowned and asked me to join him in his office. He had a chair that was on a platform so that he sat higher than me. He looked at a portrait of Winston Churchill on the wall and said, Matthew, that is merely your opinion on cheeseburgers. While you are with us, you will learn to appreciate fine wines and cheese, and not the opinions of the masses. It was just a figure of speech, I said. I just like cheeseburgers. He wagged his finger at me and repeated himself to the word. He was dead curious. I started to feel uncomfortable. As the weeks stretched on, I needed to find my footing, a discipline I could dedicate myself to so I could keep my sanity. I decided to become a vegetarian. I didn't know how, so I just ate a head of lettuce with ketchup for dinner, every night. I ran 6 miles every day after work. I decided to go abstinent for the rest of the year. I believed I was meant to be a monk. I made plans to go to South Africa and free Nelson Mandela. I wrote letters to family and friends, which grew increasingly longer and more convoluted. Only 2 people ever wrote me back, so I mostly wrote to myself. But I was fine. Right? 5 months into my stay, I was 140 pounds, and my nose was running constantly. Every night, I take a bath, listen to one of the 3 cassettes I owned, write a 15-page letter to myself, and jack off to Lord Byron. I was on my 6th job. During dinner, Norval decided that for the duration of my stay there, I was to call him and Marjorie Mum and Pop. I was speechless. "Thank you," I said, "but I have a mom and dad." Norval repeated himself, "Exactly." I finished my ketchup and lettuce in silence. I cleared the table and did the dishes. Before I went upstairs, I stopped to say goodnight, Norval. "Goodnight, Marjorie." I'd decided I wasn't going to do it. Alone in a foreign country, I took responsibility for who I was and what I believed in. In order to survive, I couldn't lose an anchor of my identity. The next morning, I was woken by the sound of a shrieking woman. "He won't call me?" Downstairs, I found Marjorie bawling her eyes out, tears splashing onto the kitchen table. I decided it was time to find another family. I reached out to the local Rotary Club, who made arrangements. It would be 4 days before I was ready to leave. In that time, I heard nothing from the Dooleys. No farewell party, no nothing. On the day I was supposed to leave, 30 minutes before I was going to be picked up, Norval knocked on my door. "Marjorie and I have decided that you will be staying with us for the duration of your stay. Unpack your bags." I took the high road again. "Thank you for offering," I said, "but I want to experience as much as possible this year, and a new family will be a different experience." Norval raised his chin and repeated himself, "Exactly." I lost my shit. I punched a hole through my door and pulled it out, my arm bloody. I was shaking. He was, too. So, he turned and ran. I switched families. My time with the Dooleys was a mental hell, a true red light, at the time. But I'd made a deal to stay, so I toughed it out. It wasn't until later that I realized all of that suffering and loneliness would be one of the most important sacrifices of my life. On that trip, I was forced to look inside myself, to make sense of what was going on around me. That year, I found myself because I was forced to. To me, it was inevitable that I was staying for the year, because I'd made a deal. So instead, I got relative. I denied the reality that the Dooleys were batshit insane and persisted. While I was going crazy, I kept telling myself that there was a lesson I was meant to learn, a silver lining. And there was. We can't appreciate the light without the shadows. We need to be thrown off balance to find our footing. Dirt roads and autobahns. I was a good student in college. I studied hard and made a lot of A's. But at the end of my sophomore year, I realized I didn't want to be a lawyer, I wanted to go to film school. I called my father to tell him my decision. I was nervous. He'd taught me to do the job well, to climb the company ladder. I'd been groomed to be the family lawyer. Film school? Shit. He picked up. I told him. Silence for 5 seconds. Then a voice, kind and inquisitive. "Is that what you want to do?" "Yes, sir," I said. Another 5 seconds of silence. "Well, don't half-ass it." They were the last words I expected to hear, and the best ones. It was the way he'd said them. He'd given me privilege, freedom, and responsibility. It's rocket fuel that's carried me to this day. Thanks, Pop. With my grades, I had no trouble getting into the honors program. But now, I was following a career path. I knew grades didn't matter, I needed to make something. I needed a job. I signed with a local talent agency and wore a pager at my hip. I would step out of class with no hesitation to drive to an audition. I got no thank yous. I directed short films, I edited, I wrote, I performed. I missed a lot of classes. One day, the dean told me that if I kept missing classes, he was going to have to fail me. I looked him in the eye and told him what I thought. Then I made a proposal. If I make it to every exam day, will you give me C's across the board? He didn't answer, but I stuck to it. At the end of my semester, I got C's for all of my classes. But I learned more than when I was making A's. My first role on screen was for a guy named Wooderson, for a movie called Dazed and Confused. There was a line in the script that excited me, sent me flying. I've since called it a launchpad line. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age. That line opened him up to me, told me who he was. I knew an audition was technically a job interview, so I made sure to shave and stuck in my shirt. The director saw me and said, "You're not really the guy, are you?" "No," I replied. "But I know who he is. I got the job. He told me not to shave." On a day when I was just meant to have my wardrobe approved, the director decided to put me in a scene. I had 30 minutes to prepare. "Who's my man?" I asked myself. "What's going on in this scene? What do I love? I love my car. I love getting high. I love rock and roll. And I love chicks." I put the car in drive. I've got 3 out of the 4, I'm about to get the 4th. I said out loud, "All right, all right, all right." Years later, those words still follow me. People say them, wear them, have them tattooed. It's an honor. Those 3 words are the very first words I said on film, on the night my hobby turned into a career. 5 days into shooting, I got a call from my mom. "Your dad's dead." I couldn't believe it. Losing my dad was my final passage into manhood. No more safety net. Time to grow up. Time to be less impressed with my life, my accomplishments and possessions, and be more involved with them. Everything I'd been revering suddenly came down to eye level. No more red sports cars. Time to turn "I would if I could" to "I can and I am." My next movie was Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation. I was booked as a Romeo, a motorcycle man who saves the victim in the end. No lines. I wanted the role of Vilmer, a killer with a mechanical leg. I stepped into the director's office, went inside without knocking, and told him my intentions. "When do you want to try out?" the director asked. "Right now," I said impulsively. "We don't have any actresses, though. Just you, me, and the secretary." I turned to her. "You mind if I try and scare you shitless?"
"Go for it," she said gamely. I went to the kitchen and grabbed a large metal spoon. I limped back in as Vilmer, pinned her in the corner, and made her cry out in fear.
I'd taken a chance, and I got the part. Green light. The art of running downhill. After a couple more movies under my belt, I started taking acting classes because I thought I needed to learn how to be a professional actor. But I couldn't seem to land a gig. I noticed I was more tense, and I wasn't taking as many risks. My intellectual exercise was getting in the way. Finally, I got a minor role in a small indie film called Scorpion Spring. No audition, shoots in 2 weeks. That was all I knew, and all I wanted to know. I got the script and didn't read it.
I decided I was going to go back to when I first started, when I was all instinct, all natural. My man was an American drug runner who ends up in a fight with Mexican smugglers.
That's all I needed to know. Improvise, easy. 2 weeks later, I show up in character.
I don't talk to anyone, I don't introduce myself. Just before we start, a production assistant gives me some sides, a mini version of the script for the day.
All the actors settle into their marks.
I guess that's when I got a little nervous. I decide, just before the camera rolls, to take a peek at the dialogue.
If it's written well, I thought, I'll just remember them because that's what my man would say. If it's not, I'll just say what he would have said. I unfolded the paper. 4 pages. Of a monologue. In Spanish. I learned a lesson that day. We prepare in order to have freedom. We do the work so that we can do the job. Knowing my man doesn't mean I know Spanish. My next movie was A Time to Kill. On the day of the opening, I took a walk to get a sandwich. Just an ordinary day. Of the 400 or so people walking around, maybe 4 people thought anything of me. That weekend, the movie made $15 million a box office hit.
On Monday, I went back to get another sandwich. It was not an ordinary day. Or the 400 or so people, maybe 4 people didn't stare at me. I was famous. 4 months later, I was in high demand. Dozens of offers came in. I was hungry to work, but I didn't know what to do. One of my strengths is that I can find an angle on anything, but now with everything in front of me, it became a weakness. Feeling the pressure to make a decision, and smothered by my new fame, I wanted to get away from it all. I needed to hear myself think. I had a wet dream. I saw myself floating in the Amazon River, surrounded by African tribesmen. It was a sign. I packed a backpack with some clothes, my journal and camera, and headed to South America for a 22-day solo adventure. On the 12th night, I was in a state in my tent. The entire trip, I hadn't been able to enjoy the sights because I was too anxious to get to my destination. I was guilty about my past sins, lonely, and disgusted with my own company. I couldn't sleep, so I stopped trying. I stripped off my clothes, all my banners and expectations, every idol that gave me comfort and security. Who was I? I was just a child of God. Naked, I vomited until there was nothing left in me, and passed out. I woke refreshed and energized. I dressed and went for a walk to nowhere in particular. I felt alive, clean, bright. I turned a corner and saw a mirage, a kaleidoscope of thousands of butterflies in vibrant pinks and blues and reds. I heard a little voice say, "All I want is what I can see. All I can see is in front of me." Past the butterflies, I saw, for the very first time, the Amazon River. I hadn't found the truth. It had found me. Why? I'd put myself in a place to be found. I believe the truth is always around us, but we don't always see it. First, we need to put ourselves in a place to receive it. Then, we need to be aware enough to recognize it. We need to ask ourselves what the truth means and why it's here now. We must pay attention to the truth. Don't let it fly away. If we've made it that far, we then need the courage to live it. I spent 2 weeks canoeing the Amazon River. When I came back, I was ready to roll the highways of the United States. I bought a van, renovated it, and hit the road. It's been my ideal office ever since. The arrow doesn't seek the target draws the arrow. A few years later, I'd settled down. I'd settled into a comfortable niche playing the lead in romantic comedies, and I'd met the woman of my dreams literally. Camila was 6 months pregnant when I made the decision to clean house. I shut down my production company and my music label. With that aside, I could focus on my family and my acting career. I was a successful actor at that point. I didn't have to worry about putting food on the table, but I wasn't satisfied with the roles I was getting. My life was full and lively. I was a more interesting person in life than my characters were. I wanted to be in stories that challenged the man I was and the life I was living. And those roles weren't coming my way. It was time to make a real sacrifice, see what I could really live without. I called my agent and told I wanted to stop doing romantic comedies and wanted to focus on dramatic roles. It was a risky bet. If you pass on too many projects in Hollywood, they might stop asking. Nothing personal, just business. I talked to Camila about the decision. "It's gonna be a dry season for a while," she said. "Who knows for how long? I know it's gonna be hard, but if we're gonna do this, then we're gonna go all the way. No half-ass in it. Deal?" Just like my dad said all those years ago. We all want to succeed. The question is, what does success look like to us? More money? A happy family? Helping others? Expressing ourselves? Continue asking yourself this question. The answer may change over time. That's okay. But never make a choice that will jeopardize your soul. Prioritize who you are and who you want to be. Don't spend time with anything that damages your character. A year went by with dozens of offers for romantic comedies and only romantic comedies. Out of respect, I read them all, but passed every single one. I got an offer worth $5 million. Then 8, then 10, then 14.5. Boom. It was a better script than the other ones, but it wasn't any different. I declined. 2 years passed, with me struggling against my own fear, my own sense of significance. It seemed like I was forgotten. Family helped me believe that me holding out was a way of biding my time, that abstaining today was an investment for later.
Suddenly, I became. Casting me became a fresh thought. Bernie. The paper boy. Mud. Magic Mike.
Yes, by saying no. The arrow doesn't draw the target draws the arrow.
I knew what I wanted, and I was ready to take it.
Green light. I'd read a script for a movie called Dallas Buyers Club in 2007, and attached myself to it as the lead character.
For years, no directors or financiers were interested in making a drama about AIDS with rom-com McConaughey.
In 2012, a director named Jean-Marc Vallée said he was interested, and I liked his work.
We met and discussed the project. I'd just done Magic Mike, and I was in excellent shape.
Your character has stage 4 HIV, Jean-Marc asked me.
How are you going to look like him?
Because it's my job and my responsibility. A week later, he signed on to the project.
We started filming on October.
Weighing 182 pounds, I had a lot of weight to lose in 5 months.
I stuck to my diet, and I shed 2.5 pounds a week.
There's no money to make the movie, Matthew, my agent told me.
There's no movie. I didn't flinch.
We're shooting in the fall. I said to anyone who asked, and anyone who didn't. I continued losing weight. My body got weaker, but my mind got stronger.
I was obsessed with my man. I was on fire. Finally, someone put up $4.9 million for the movie.
It didn't meet our minimum budget of $7 million, but it was enough to get us started. 8 days before we started filming, Jean-Marc called me. I do not know how I am going to shoot with this budget, he told me.
But if you show up on day one, I will be there too, and we'll make what we can make. And we did.
We made Dallas Buyers Club in 25 days with $4.9 million.
We did not ask for permission. We climbed that hill.
I got down to 135 pounds.
Live your legacy now. I won an Oscar for Best Actor.
I was incredibly honored, validated that my choices were paying off. I wasn't half a sign it. Many of my succeeding movies were box office failures, but they only made me more committed to performing, to creating.
I loved the work more than ever. I was more than an entertainer, I was an artist.
The stories in my movies now seemed more vibrant than the story of my life.
So I made a plan. Make my life my favorite movie. Write my own script, be my own documentary. Live my legacy now.
I took some time with myself, in the places that were important to me.
I looked myself in my eye.
It was scary, and it got bloody.
But I laughed, I cried, I wowed.
As I approach the next chapter of my life, I only know for sure that I will change again, and my family will always be at my core when I do. It's hard to find constants, but when we have children, there is no discussion, no philosophy.
It's an instinctive commitment, an infinite responsibility and privilege. A green light.
As I was finishing this book, my life and yours was disrupted by the red light of COVID-19.
The drama was inevitable.
We had to get relative. We all had to make sacrifices, pivot, and persist. Another red light came with George Floyd's murder. Protests, looting, fear, a social justice revolution. These red lights forced us inward, quarantined our souls.
How much did we change for good?
The benefits of what we went through is relative. But if we work to make the change for a more value-driven future, then inevitably, the red light of 2020 will one day turn green.
Life is our story to tell. One day, will we look back fondly on it? We will all die one day. Our story will be told by others, an introduction for when we are long gone. Begin with the end in mind, and just keep living.
Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.